Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the Voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for the Agriculture Report and Science in the News, coming up after As It Is.
Hello, and welcome to As It Is from VOA Learning English. I'm Christopher Cruz in Washington. Today on the program, we report on the growing number of women who are joining jihadi groups in the Middle East. Hundreds of young Europeans and others have joined the groups. Experts estimate that up to 10% of the new members are women.
This idea of radicalization is very, very popular at the moment, but actually our understanding of it is very limited.
Then we will report on the continuing effects of the third year of drought in the Western American state of California. This water shortage is causing many Californians to urge the state to change its water policy. Early next month, Californians will vote on a plan to improve the state's water supply.
We've been doing things a certain way for over 100 years, but everything has changed. We have climate change, we have these unprecedented droughts.
The growing number of European women joining jihadi groups and the growing effect of drought on the people of California. Those are our subjects today on As It Is from VOA. Hundreds of young Europeans and others have joined jihadist groups in the Middle East. Experts estimate that up to 10% of the new members are women. These women are reacting to the lure or appeal of a pure Islamic state, and they seem to like the idea of fighting in combat for the jihadists. Bob Doty has more.
Hundreds of girls and young women are leaving Western nations to join the Islamic State and other radical groups. It is hard to say how many join, but France appears to be a leading exporter of such women. Almost 1,000 jihadi fighters came from France. More than 60 of them were women. Catherine Brown is a lecturer with the Defense Studies Department at King's College London. She has been studying the role of women in jihadi movements.
This idea of radicalization is very, very popular at the moment, but actually our understanding of it is very limited because what's become really, really clear is that individual motives are very, very diverse.
Ms. Brown has looked at social media to find out why Western women are interested in joining the jihadis.
Women join radical groups and travel to Islamic State for both personal and political reasons. I really resist this idea of saying it's all about, you know, emotion, or it's all about finding a husband. It's all impulsive or irrational.
She says some women do want to become jihadi brides, someone who marries a jihadist fighter. But others like the idea of a Muslim nation, such as one described by the self-described Islamic State, even when Islamic State methods are clearly brutal. Dunia Buzar heads a new Paris center to prevent people from becoming radicals. She says men are interested in arguments like fighting evil. Recruiters use humanitarian arguments to lure women. Ms. Buzar says the recruiter's first method is getting women to believe they must die in the Holy Land to save those they love. She said a second way is to tell them they must do good works there. She says that interests lots of women who want to become doctors, healthcare, or social workers. But Islamist expert Louis Caprioli says the Islamic State also is sending a more activist message. He is a former top anti-terrorism official.
L'État islamique a fait un changement complet.
Mr. Caprioli says the Islamic State supports women in the jihad, so it is not just going out to do social work. But he says it is urging them to really take an active part. He says videos show women using strong language, threatening to kill people, and holding guns. Catherine Brown says these images have a strong effect, even if few women really fight.
And the reason it's significant is because of our biases, because it's powerful in our society to see women engaging in acts of violence. So it's a propaganda coup.
I'm Bob Doty.
You are listening to As It Is on The Voice of America. People in California are suffering the effects of the state's third year of drought. This water shortage is causing many Californians to urge the state to change its water policy. Early next month, Californians have a chance to vote on a plan to improve the state's water supply. Jerry Watson has the story.
The fountains are dry at the J. Paul Getty Museum in Los Angeles. Museum officials turned off the water as part of a statewide campaign to save water. Officials have restricted use of water on grass, trees, and other plants. And those who disobey the rules can be punished. People living in Los Angeles recently heard the head of the local water agency talk about the crisis. His comments about the shortage worried Sherry Shankar. She heard him speak at a meeting held by the group Town Hall Los Angeles.
We've been doing things a certain way for over 100 years, but everything has changed. We have climate change. We have these unprecedented droughts.
The third year of extremely dry weather has left some reservoirs, water supply centers, at almost record low levels. And the springtime snowpack measures 20% below normal. The springtime snowpack provides much of California's water. Prices for California farm produce are rising. As further proof of the crisis, farmers in the usually fertile Central Valley are not planting their fields. Dan Arataberry grows pistachio and almond nuts, garlic, wine grapes, and other crops near the city of Fresno. He depends on groundwater, which he pumps himself. But the amount of water he can receive from the state has fallen to zero. He says the results of the drought are shocking. Doug Parker is a water policy expert with the California Institute for Water Resources at the University of California. Mr. Parker says the water system has fallen behind in meeting the state's needs. He says the climate and water sources are both experiencing more changes now than in the past.
What we do know from the climate change data is that we're going to get more droughts, and we're also going to have more flood-type years as well. So we need to be able to build a system and have a system that adapts to that variability in water.
A few California communities are now depending on emergency water supplies voters will be asked in November to pay for improvements to the water system. I'm Jerry Watson.
That's our program for today. I'm Christopher Cruz. Thank you for listening.
The Agriculture Report is next, followed by Science in the News. You can read and listen to our programs and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Agriculture Report. The World Wildlife Fund says more than half of the world's wildlife population has been lost. The conservation group says this has placed the health of the planet at risk. The WWF recently released its 10th flagship Living Planet Report. The group warns the condition of the world's animals is worse than its earlier reports showed. It says worldwide action is needed. The WWF says it is worried about the loss of and damage to Earth's environment. The report provides information about more than 10,000 animal populations from 1970 to 2010. These populations are called vertebrate species, or animals with backbones, like fish, birds, mammals, amphibians, and reptiles. The report says these populations have dropped by 52% in just 40 years. It says freshwater species have fallen by 76%. That is almost twice the loss of land and ocean species. Most of these losses are in the tropics. The report says the biggest drop has been in Latin America. Marco Lambertini is the WWF's International Director General. He spoke to VOA about the report.
This is about losing natural habitats. It's about converting forest, grasslands, and wetlands into agriculture mainly. And it is about unsustainable use of wildlife. So wildlife traffic, hunting, unsustainable hunting practices like that. Poaching, as you mentioned, has been actually increasing over the last 10 years and is definitely a driving force for extinction, particularly of large species. But also, as you mentioned, there are dimensions of poaching that are related to timber, illegal logging, and also fisheries.
The report also notes what it calls the world's ecological footprint. That is, the effect of human activities on the planet. Mr. Lambertini says there has been an increase in carbon dioxide gases and the pouring of nitrogen into oceans and rivers from fertilizers used in agriculture. He says this cannot continue.
So we are consuming on average every year about equivalent of about 1.5, 1.5 times the resources available in the planet. That means we are cutting trees more quicker than they can be restored. We are fishing the oceans more quickly than fish stocks can reproduce. And we are emitting in the atmosphere more CO2 than the natural systems can actually absorb. This is clearly not sustainable.
Mr. Lambertini warns climate change affects almost everyone on the planet. He says whole species may disappear if the world does not reduce the effects of humans on the climate. I'm Ann Ball. From VOA Learning English, this is Science in the News. Today, Shirley Griffith and Christopher Cruz tell the stories of some medical heroes.
At the start of the 20th century, the United States Army had a yellow fever commission. The Army wanted medical experts to study yellow fever and find a way to stop the disease. One team went to Cuba to test the idea that mosquitoes spread yellow fever. The team was led by Walter Reed, the Army doctor and scientist noted for his work on infectious diseases. In August of 1900, the researchers began to raise mosquitoes and infect them with the virus. 9 of the Americans let the infected insects bite them. Nothing happened. Then 2 more let the mosquitoes bite them. Both men developed yellow fever.
A doctor named Jesse William Lazier recognized that the mosquitoes that bit the last 2 men had been older than the others. Dr. Lazier proved that mosquitoes did carry yellow fever. Dr. Lazier himself was also bitten. No one is sure how it happened. He said it happened accidentally as he treated others. But some people said he placed the mosquito on his arm as part of the experiment. Medical historians say he may have reported the bite as an accident, so his family would not be denied money from his life insurance policy.
Jesse Lazier died of yellow fever. His death shocked the others on the team in Cuba, but they continued their work. More people let themselves be bitten by mosquitoes. Others were injected with blood from the victims of yellow fever. Some people in this test group developed the disease, but all recovered to full health. Members of the team praised the work by Jesse Lazier. They called it a sacrifice to research that led the way to one of the greatest medical discoveries of the century.
The research answered the question of how yellow fever was spread. Now the question was how to protect people. The researchers had a theory. They thought that people who were bitten by infected mosquitoes, but recovered, were protected in the future. To test this idea, the team in Cuba offered $100 to anyone who would agree to be bitten by infected mosquitoes. 19 people agreed. The only American was Clara Moss. She was a nurse who worked with yellow fever patients in Cuba. Clara Moss was bitten by infected mosquitoes 7 times between March and August of 1901. Only 1 of the 19 people developed the disease until that August. Then, 7 people got yellow fever. Clara Moss died 6 days after she was bitten for the 7th time.
The experiment showed that the bite of an infected mosquito was not a safe way to protect people from yellow fever. Medical historians say the death of Clara Moss also created a public protest over the use of humans in yellow fever research. Such experiments ended. Cuba and the United States both honored Clara Moss on postage stamps. And today, a hospital in her home state of New Jersey is known as the Clara Moss Medical Center.
Joseph Goldberger was a doctor for the United States Public Health Service. In 1912, he began to study a skin disease that was killing thousands of people in the South. The disease was pellagra. Dr. Goldberger traveled to the state of Mississippi, where many people suffered from pellagra. He studied the victims and their families. Most of the people were poor. The doctor came to believe that the disease was not infectious, but instead related to diet. He received permission from the state governor to test this idea at a prison. Prisoners were offered pardons if they took part. One group of prisoners received their usual foods, mostly corn products. A second group ate meat, fresh vegetables, and milk. Members of the first group developed pellagra. The second group did not.
But some medical researchers refused to accept that a poor diet caused pellagra. For the South, pellagra was more than simply a medical problem. There were other issues involved, including Southern pride. So Dr. Goldberger had himself injected with blood from a person with pellagra. He also took liquid from the nose and throat of a pellagra patient and put them into his own nose and throat. He even swallowed pills that contained skin from pellagra patients. An assistant also took part in the experiments. So did Dr. Goldberger's wife. None of them got sick. Later, the doctor discovered that a small amount of dried brewer's yeast each day could prevent pellagra. Joseph Goldberger died of cancer in 1929. He was 55 years old. Several years later, researchers discovered the exact cause of pellagra, a lack of the B vitamin known as niacin.
Matthew Luquia was the medical administrator of St. Mary's Hospital in the Gulu district of northern Uganda. In 2000, the hospital was the center of treatment for an outbreak of Ebola. The virus causes severe bleeding. No cure is known. Doctors can only hope that victims are strong enough to survive. Dr. Luquia acted quickly to control the spread of infection. He kept the people with Ebola separate from the other patients. He ordered hospital workers to wear protective clothing and follow other safety measures. One day, he had to deal with a patient who was dying of Ebola. The man had been acting out of control. The doctor knew him well. The patient was a nurse who worked at the hospital. The man was coughing and bleeding. Dr. Luquia violated one of his own rules. He wore no protection over his eyes. Matthew Luquia died from the virus in December of 2000. He was only 42 years old. Ugandans mourned his death. He was an important influence in the community. Experts say his work during the outbreak helped stop the Ebola virus from spreading out of control.
On February 28, 2003, the Vietnam-France Hospital in Hanoi asked Carlo Urbani for help. The Italian doctor was an expert on communicable diseases. He was based in Vietnam for the World Health Organization. The hospital asked Dr. Urbani to help identify an unusual infection. he recognized it as a new threat. He made sure other hospitals increased their infection control measures. On March 11th, Dr. Urbani developed signs of severe acute respiratory syndrome. 4 days later, the World Health Organization declared it a worldwide health threat. Carlo Urbani was the first doctor to warn the world of the disease that became known as SARS. He died of it on March 29, 2003. He was 46 years old.
Our final medical hero is an American, molecular biologist Anita Roberts. She was widely recognized by other researchers for her work with a protein called transforming growth factor beta. TGF-beta can both heal wounds and make healthy cells cancerous. In 1976, Anita Roberts joined the National Cancer Institute, part of the National Institutes of Health. She worked for many years with another researcher, Michael Sporn. They found that TGF-beta helps to heal wounds and is important in the body's defense system against disease. At the same time, though, the two scientists found that the protein can also support the growth of cancer in some cells.
Between 1983 and 2002, Anita Roberts published more than 340 research papers. Many other scientists gave credit to her published work. In fact, the publication Science Watch listed her as the 49th most cited researcher in the world during that 20-year period. She was the third most cited female scientist. But in 2004, after years of studying cancer, Anita Roberts learned that she herself had the disease. She died of gastric cancer in May of 2006. She was 64 years old.
This was written by George Grow. Your announcers were Shirley Griffith and Christopher Cruz. Join us again next week at this time for more news about science on The Voice of America.